Hi, everybody. Cora here. Welcome back to Rev on Air, the Rev on Vair podcast, a place for sustainable storytelling with founders, activists, creatives, and phenomenal individuals who are paving the way for a more conscious future for us all. Today, I'm so excited to have on a woman I really admire who is working in the space of regenerative agriculture. Named as one of Fast Company's most creative people in business, Camilla Marcus is a chef, entrepreneur, activist, and mother of three who is challenging conventional ideas about our food systems and environmental stewardship. Camilla and I sat down at her lovely home in Los Angeles, and I can't wait to tell you a bit more about all this. But first, I just want to say a quick thank you to today's sponsor, Obaki, which has just launched its incredible new skincare line. Obaki skincare is simple. Their products are formulated with nature's wisdom in mind. They use the purest possible raw ingredients for the best and safest results. Obaki skincare is highly concentrated in naturally occurring antioxidants and nutrients to optimize and protect your skin's function to strengthen and nourish. We know you want the best for your skin, so Obaki traces the origin of each ingredient to ensure that every Obaki skincare formulation is natural, plant-based, and of the highest quality. And their products will never contain palm oil, artificial fragrances, colorants, parabens, sulfates, or animal products. Single ingredient concentrations mean that you can personalize your skincare results by hand selecting and layering a unique combination of formulations that will best nourish your own personal skin for a simple daily ritual. Obaki Skincare's full range of products are created with hand cultivated and wild harvested ingredients. Find out more and discover the line at obaki.com. That's obaki.com. So now a little bit more about my guest today, Camilla Marcus. Drawing from her Californian roots, she started Westbourne as New York City's first zero-waste certified restaurant and has now expanded its mission of eating well and doing better into a collection of regenerative, carbon-neutral provisions for the modern home. Committed to cross-industry innovation, Camilla's endeavors range from championing regenerative farming to reshaping the hospitality landscape. She co-founded Roar, Restaurants Organizing, Advocating, Rebuilding, and is a founding member of the Independent Restaurant Coalition. In addition, her passion extends to crafting a more equitable childcare system for working mothers. Today, she and I chat about the realities of running a business regeneratively, how she thinks about food in the context of ethics, business, and motherhood, and her thoughts on how we can engage with a better food system with every meal we make. It's a good one. So now, with no further ado, over to my chat with Camilla. Camilla, thank you so much for letting me first into your beautiful home and also for talking to us about regenerative grocery staples, agriculture, all of these things that we're talking about like so much at Rev in the moment. And I feel like you're kind of on a mission to make them really accessible and easy for people. And That is a dream come true, I think, for many consumers, and we're going to get into it. But first of all, can you just tell us a bit about, you know, how you started off, like what your connection to is in food was and how you got into the food space and your love of sort of farming? Because not actually everybody that works in food also understands or appreciates farming, which is kind of ironic, but true.
I agree. A lot of food companies run by marketing professionals, that is for sure. Look, really everything comes down to, I think, my origins here being a second generation LA native. It's very unusual to be one. Newly back after probably two decades on the East Coast. And look, I grew up in an environment where everyone composted, we recycled. My next door neighbor was Mrs. Gooch, who was sort of the godmother of the natural grocery movement. Whole Foods actually bought her stores when they entered Los Angeles.
Oh, wow. Okay.
So, you know, we bought at farmers markets. We knew who grew our food. We didn't talk about being plant-based, but you know, it was a very balanced sort of culinary home. We made a lot from scratch. And I think when you grow up that way, you don't realize, you know, per se till you leave that it's unusual. And I think really my passion has always been about community. And I think, you know, nothing is more powerful than food to bring us together. Most universal language we have in the world. Mm-hmm. Everyone has traditions, memories, and points of gathering around food. And so to me, I think even from an early age, I realized that that was going to be an area where I felt like it would be central to impact and right. bringing people together.
Yeah.
When I was young, I was very, very into environmental activism. I used to write letters to the president, organizations, and, you know, I look back, right, you know, hindsight's 2020, and yeah. you look back and you go, oh yeah, it sort of was always there. But again, I just felt that we have a responsibility to ourselves, to the planet, to the next generation, to think about how we can do it better. Yeah. And look, my career now, always passionate about food. I went to undergraduate business school, but cooked the whole time and always was obsessed with restaurants since I was young. I loved cooking. I loved, again, bringing people together. Mm. You know, you slow down, you talk, you debate,
yeah.
you know, you think. And to me, that's powerful. So I just always saw how that was so important to change minds. I went to culinary school after graduating college. Then the world fell apart in 2008. And I really started getting into restaurant development. So right. I worked on a project with Tom Colicchio, ended up becoming head of business development for Danny Meyer in New York.
Oh, wow.
I worked at a bunch of restaurants. I've invested in a number of restaurants. And through that world, I really think that restaurants opened my eyes, especially to the farm connection.
Mm.
You know, I was fortunate to work for chefs and restaurant owners that were connected to the source.
Yeah.
It mattered where, you know, that piece of broccoli came from. It mattered who made that item on your plate. Yes, the chefs and the teams took it to a whole new magical level, but they gave so much credit for their craft yeah. to the farmers. And I think that's where it really kind of pulled together my childhood and my early professional career.
Mm-hmm.
I used to have a restaurant in New York called Westbourne.
Yeah, and it's an amazing restaurant. And I feel like you really started pushing boundaries with it. And, you know, its inception was quite phenomenal. So tell us about, like, Westbourne the restaurant. Because
Westbourne the restaurant was, you know, I always say kind of my Trojan horse. It was, you know, around the time of conscious capitalism on the rise, right? Mm. We had retail stores and all these brands and the rise of clean beauty and everyone and every brand telling you they can do it better and it's better for you to do good. You know, it mattered what sunglasses you wore, it mattered what shoes you wore. And I could see my friends getting really obsessed. And yet that goes on the outside of your body.
Right.
It's not what goes inside. And you make more decisions about what you eat and drink than anything else in your daily life. And that compounds every single day. And again, that's universal.
Yes.
So I think it was really when I started working in restaurants in New York, when I started thinking about, okay, right, I didn't grow up with kale being so ubiquitous, and now it is.
Mm.
A lot of that is driven by restaurant and food culture. And so starting to see that chefs, restaurants can connect farms to consumers and can change their minds and their palates and their behaviors in such a transformative way, and how that wasn't as commonplace as, right, who made your lipstick and what it came in. And you know, it sort of made me laugh. I'm also sort of sad that, you know, there was just this very big obsession about sourcing, about logistics, about packaging. And again, things that were sort of superficial and outside your body.
Yeah.
So became obsessed with learning everything about it. And when Westbourne opened, it was the first zero waste certified restaurant in Manhattan. We worked very closely with farmers. And again, that's really where I started to become obsessed with the regenerative agricultural movement. And then when you really look at the data, it's the only sector that can pull down carbon in time. And you know, it's amazing that you see this. I know you had Dan Barber on your podcast. I've been fortunate enough to spend a lot of time at Blue Hill, you know, as an, I don't know, unofficial intern, I guess, through, you know, dear friends. And it's amazing how much that drum has been beaten and yet really hasn't become totally mainstream yet. And you see all this venture capital money. I mean, this is sort of where the restaurant, you know, leverages and catapults into the products, which is you see all this money, all this media attention, all this investment in the millions and billions going into things coming out of a lab, things that have nothing to do with emissions, things that have nothing to do with regenerative agriculture. And yet all the numbers are there. So I sit sort of feeling a little bit, you know, banging hands against the glass, which I'm sure many of us are, walk down the grocery aisle and it's not there. Yeah. You know, I think we're in the moment of it becoming what organic was maybe 10 years ago. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think most people still can't tell the difference between non-GMO and organic. I think your average consumer doesn't, but it's mission critical. And so I think for me, that's my life's work, has been and will continue to be until that's the new normal.
Yeah. And
just
I,
like kale.
Yeah. Well, I mean, if kale can become like a exactly. sexy staple, then really anything can happen, you know? Exactly. And I think it is really interesting too, you know, like, I think when we're talking about making things mainstream, one of the issues, like you said, Dan has been talking about this for years and years and years, but also there's a certain element that, like, you know, very few people can afford to eat at Blue Hill, you know, it's an incredible experience when you can. And to be honest, like when we were there and we had lunch and we were eating the produce, you know, you're like, oh my God, I just wish that we could share this with the entire world because it really does taste magnificent and the experience is magnificent and the farm. But there is a certain exclusivity to that whether we want it to be or not, just isn't really scalable. So enter sort of the idea that you've had, which I feel like is maybe making regenerative agriculture accessible in a way that like a working mother can obtain, or a busy college student, or, you know, anyone kind of. So tell us about like sort of the evolution of Westbourne into something a little bit more tangible than just a restaurant.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting. It was actually always part of our business plan to do products. And then COVID hit. I've had 3 kids since, so we've been busy.
Oh my God. Yeah.
Moved across the country. You know, we've moved 7 places in the last, you know, couple of years. So it's, you know, my life really went sort of upside down in 2020, personally and professionally. We had to close the restaurant. We had a really tough landlord situation. And then I really decided to dedicate, frankly, my life for that year to restaurant relief. So sort of saw a lot of friends. You know, I remember the day of shutdown, and I remember, you know, shelter in place. And I called the head of Robin Hood, Wes Moore, now governor of Maryland. And I said, Wes, restaurant people can't work from home. So what happens tomorrow when the paycheck doesn't come in? He was like, no one is thinking about that. And I said, well, we have millions and millions of people across the country that now don't have help. What are we going to do when all those people hit the unemployment system in, you know, whenever it registers?
Yeah,
we're kind of screwed. So that was the detour, and then settled back in California and decided to go forward with our original plan, which was our product. So it, you know, I think it's perceived as an evolution, but it was actually always the plan, because you can only touch so many people in the four walls, which is exactly what you were alluding to. And look, the way to change minds is through someone's hearth in their home, how they cook. And that starts in, you know, grocery stores and where we buy our food.
Yeah.
And for farmers too, right? Regenerative farming depends on biodiversity. And the thing that I keep harping on is they're growing crops for some sort of main stage, right? Whether that's one or a few, whether that's to a large partner, whether that's to the produce shelves of a main grocery store, but what happens to the rest of the farm? If we believe in biodiversity being key, if we believe in that being important for soil health, which it is, then we need products to be built around that. And we need to move off of monolith industrially created products, which is exactly the problem. It's sort of the tail wagging the dog and the dog wagging the tail. They need to work together.
Yeah.
So that's where we enter, is a passion for chef created, you know, ultimately it has to be delicious. Unlike a lipstick where you might be like, oh, it's not exactly a shade of pink, but it's clean. I'll do it.
Yeah.
You know, if you don't like something, you're not going to eat it again. That's the truth.
Yeah.
Bare bones. It has to be.
It does.
It has to be craveably delicious. And, you know, it was my ethos in the restaurant too, was I want you to come, I want you to enjoy, I want you to be blown away on a blind taste test. But I also then want you to take a click in and realize that you're actually making an impact. Yeah. I think our communities want to help solve the climate crisis. I think people just really don't know how. For example, when you hear regenerative farming, to me, you know, friends, colleagues, people not necessarily in this industry, they know what it is. Regenivore was the New York Times word of the year.
Yeah.
But what do you do, right? You know, to them, it's sort of, I think people look at it as, oh, it's about these acres outside of my life, outside of my control, outside of my ability. How do we re-empower everyone to be part of the solution? And so that's sort of how we view Westbourne, is that connective tissue through, you know, craveable everyday products.
Well, and it's so funny. We were literally, as we drove here, we came down from Santa Barbara this morning. And as we were coming in on, you know, on the Highway 1, you go past these agricultural fields of sprayers and monocrops. And, you know, my husband was pointing out, like, he was like, oh my God, like there was somebody tilling and spraying and we had the windows down. He was like, put the windows up, put the windows up. And we were looking out, and being from coastal Maine now, we don't see this, right? Like we do not see this where we were. And it was really stark. Like I have to say, actually seeing it was dark. Like,
but it's interesting because that entire region is so mixed though, because I would say 20 minutes away are some of the best regenerative farms in California who are run by some of the most incredible humans you'll ever meet.
Well, so we were at Ojai Roots, but you know, it's like, and because El Encanto where we were staying, that's where they're using. And it's really interesting to me, like how this is all kind of existing. And I was like, you know, is it old with new? Is it mass with small? Like, you know, how do you kind of see the, because you're here, right? And you're dealing with it. Are you seeing farmers talking about it more? Are you seeing movement? Like, yeah, tell us about it.
I do. I mean, I think the biggest indicator for me over the past maybe year that I've seen is really the rise of financing options at a real institutional scalable level. Okay. I mean, everyone knows farm loans, farm financing, already very difficult, not
horrible,
much like early stage companies, not an easy feat. But we are seeing a lot of Stewart is one, Mad Agriculture is another. They have an arm called Mad Capital, part of their nonprofit. And they're all really institutional lending programs to facilitate farms transitioning to regenerative. To me, I think there's no greater proof point that we are past early innings.
Right, exactly. And so in terms of just like your own personal experiences, are you seeing, because I think a lot of people, we've got a lot of young entrepreneurs, young business people that listen to the podcast, you know, how have you, from starting Westbourne and, you know, being an investor in restaurants yourself and kind of being, I think finances is something a lot of people, they get the heebie-jeebies talking about in the environmental space. Like seriously, I was talking about this with somebody at Farmers Footprint because they now have a for-profit section called Biome Capital that is literally trying to bridge this gap of like offshooting some of the huge amounts of capital that you were talking about that goes into conventional agriculture into regenerative farms. And David Leon from Biome, he was like, you know, even my colleagues at Farmers Footprint, like we get a little worried about talking about for-profit and investment and hedge fund managers and, you know, like all these people that are part of the system. And he was like, but we can't burn down the system. We have to just like make the system work a little bit differently. But I'd love to hear your take on this because it's important to talk about.
I've spent my entire career, I feel, at the intersection of for-profit and nonprofit. I mean, even I'm a JD MBA. I went to a public policy focused law school focused on corporate law. I mean, I felt the heat even then. My biggest personal value system that I say to my team, and I really believe to my core, you can't give from an empty cup. So there also has to be some element of for-profit to help nonprofits and vice versa. I really look at them as synergistic if done in the right way and if done thoughtfully, mm-hmm. but right, the transition to regenerative is going to take time and money. Those are the facts. And it's not just going to get there from the ether. Farming is hard. I also think if we're going to take the perspective of, you know, capitalism, you know, for better or worse, I am a capitalist at heart. I mm-hmm. do believe in that with a lot of socialist values probably, but
I think there's a lot of people, I would say that's like true, you know, like if you're running,
I don't know if I'm allowed to say that these days.
No, but if you're running a business, like you have to be, right? Like it's like, you know,
because I think look around the world, some of the greatest philanthropy is done by the private sector. I mean, look, even Restaurant Relief, that was a huge lift of a nonprofit, certainly the Independent Restaurant Coalition moved mountains, but alongside a ton of businesses who put a ton of weight behind it.
Yeah.
In fact, it was interesting. I had a breakfast this morning with a very notable garden farming nonprofit. And I said, look, you know, you may not want to hear this, but the biggest advice I would have is put a consortium of the top and biggest, baddest 5 to 10 national, if not global corporations that would put their weight behind you because Washington's going to listen to that.
Yeah.
You are an amazing organization, but unfortunately, you know, again, our geopolitical and, you know, economic systems have a lot of flaws, but you know, you, like you said, play to them, play in it and play it to your best of the way you can to get the maximum impact.
Yeah.
You know, we do have to put our weight behind changing the farm bill. We do have to be thinking about public policy. They do have to go hand in hand. But again, you really can't give from an empty cup. And I do think there has to be a partnership. And I think to put this all on farms also isn't fair and isn't right and isn't going to get the job done. No. So, you know, there isn't, I don't know. I think part of that is also, we don't talk about money early often, you know, it doesn't have to be a taboo topic. It is a necessary piece of the puzzle.
Well, yeah, because I think if you're a young entrepreneur or you're a farmer trying to make changes, like if you leave out the financial element, it's just, there's going to be hardly any movement, right? And it's unrealistic to do that. Exactly. And
it just does.
It does. And I think, you know, it's important to kind of have these conversations, but you're saying what you're seeing now is, you know, a lot of conversations we've had in our Farmers Footprint series has been scalability, right? Like I was just on the phone with Richard at Flamingo Estate and he was saying that, you know, he was like, I went to LVMH for investment. I was like, you know, do you feel comfortable saying that? He was like, absolutely. Like, let's talk about this. You know, like he was like, shouldn't LVMH be putting their money into companies like Flamingo Estate? Like, shouldn't they be supporting small scale regenerative farmers? Like, shouldn't we be talking about it? And it was really interesting because I was like, you know, you're the first person to come on and like openly want to say that you kind of went to LVMH for capital investment. And he was like, you know, but he sees it just very clearly. Like he was like, you know, I worked in the luxury market for 20 years and he said something I loved so much. He was like, you know, Mother Nature is our last great luxury. Like if we lose her, we have nothing else. And everything comes from Mother Nature. And I think like we're starting to make these connections that like if the land goes, if the topsoil goes, if the farm goes, we have no clothing. We have no food. We have nothing. So actually like these conversations are so important to have and to kind of be realistic about. And
so I see a little bit of a different side to it.
Oh, well,
and
tell
I may
me.
Be a little controversial, which is
yes.
I don't think it should be a luxury. I think that's part of the issue is that Mother Nature does need to be for everyone. It needs to be for our health, for the future, for our air, for our water. And I do think that actually is the tension in what's happening right now.
Mm.
I think that is the tension of the scalability, accessibility, right?
Mm-hmm.
Regenerative farming is small-ish. It's growing actually quite quickly and there is the transformation afoot, but you know, compared to right industrial farming in this country, it pales. It also is disaggregated. Ironically for me, I actually see it quite in parallel to independent restaurants, right? Second largest employer next to healthcare, but most restaurateurs are single unit operators. So huge employment block should actually be really powerful in Washington, but because it's disaggregated, it's written off as small. Restaurants are not a small business. And I would say the same about regenerative farms.
Mm-hmm.
They're being written off for no scale because they're disaggregated, but not actually because they're small. They're not in fact small and they would grow if they were given the capital, resources, and demand. And so there is this tension of, and we get it too. I mean, we're raising our seed round right now and that's a big push and pull. You're expensive. I said, well, we're running really small quantities right now.
Right.
What we're raising for is to get to that next level of scale. Then of course we do want to pull down costs so that it is accessible, but day one, someone has to bear the burden, right? If you're bootstrapped, you can't do that. If you have investment, the way a lot of cellular meat companies have, right? Unit economics are out the door for at least 5 years.
Right.
You can't have it both ways. So I do think regenerative for me has been put in this really kind of rock and hard place.
Mm.
I do think it's being positioned as high end because it does cost more right now. But it doesn't have to be that way. So I get a lot of questions too. Your products are expensive. I said, well, they're organic. They're regeneratively grown. You know, we have a carbon neutral supply chain. We don't use plastic. Plastic is cheap because we subsidize it. It's not inherently cheap. The things in this country that things that are regenerative, you know, again, more mindful practices when it comes to products, they're not more expensive in absolute. They're more expensive because our taxpaying dollars, our subsidies, our government policies have decided that something else should be cheaper that we decided in 1950 should stay cheaper 70 years later. So again, I do actually think that concept of luxury is interesting because that's kind of inherently the problem.
Mm.
Is it is being pinpointed as luxury. It shouldn't be, it can't be, and it doesn't have to be,
mm-hmm.
but it's also being paralleled to commodity food that again, isn't inherently cheap. We have made it cheap.
Exactly.
So it's complicated.
No, and thank you for articulating that because I agree with you.
By the way, this is me coming off of Paris Fashion Week with, you know, friends in the luxury sector going through their markets and seeing that a bodega can have thoughtful, nutritious, and vibrant food. I'm like, oh, I wish every place that we bought food in communities across the states looked like that.
Yeah, exactly.
In glass jars, you don't see plastic. There's no plastic wrap. There's no plastic bags. I mean, it is just, I mean, I spent maybe 4 hours in this one corner bodega. My husband's like, can we see Paris?
Yeah.
I don't understand. Like, this is my dream.
Yeah, but it is, you know, and I think we are getting to a place where, and I really like that you picked up on this. So I kind of want to just dive into it a little bit more. Like, because I think people don't always sort of associate economies of scale with like what they already think of as luxury or regenerative farming or any of these things. Like, it only seems like economies of scale can exist in the way that we kind of currently already exist, because that's how it's been for, like you said, 70 years or something like that. But how do you see regenerative farming growing? Like, you know, if you're taking this to investors and you're saying, okay, we can get this to be cheaper, we can get this to be bigger, we can kind of work this out to have a better price point for more people, like, how are you kind of placing that this is going to happen?
Well, one, I think it's already happening. I mean, I don't know if that's, again, maybe an unpopular opinion, but
it's a very popular, like, that's what we want. That's what people want to hear.
But it is amazing. I mean, I get that question from investors a lot, and I say, have you read our deck? Because I'm sharing the data.
Yeah.
I mean, it is the number one concern for Gen Z is the climate crisis. It's the number one psychological issue for anyone under the age of 30.
Mm-hmm.
Like, that is massive. That is the only thing that they're thinking about. And this is the only industry that can actually do something about it within the time that we need.
Right.
So one, it's already happening. Two, it's actually absolutely singularly mission critical. And three, the way I position it, but I also believe is already underway, is three parts. First is regenerative farms. The transition is coming. It's underway. It is growing, and there's capital behind it.
Mm-hmm.
That's the first thing. Second is the demand side. As I said, it is absolutely a different community of people when you look at young millennials and Gen Z.
Mm-hmm.
They're behaving totally different. They care about where things are sourced, how it's getting to their door. They're obsessed with transparency in every detail in a way that no other generation can understand. They are spending less at a higher quality, and it matters. So you actually do have supply and demand. It's just everyone else around saying, no, this is niche. No, it can't work.
Yeah,
it can. The third piece is, how do you connect the two? We need more products built on regenerative farms. So to agree with Richard, but also politely somewhat disagree, I don't think it should be luxury and something that's only kept to a singular few. But I also do agree with him. We do need to be investing in products that are built on regenerative farms. If farms are going to grow into their acreage, they need a place to put their produce.
Yeah.
Right? What they're growing, they need to put into the market.
Right.
And that can't just be on a produce shelf with perishables, with, as we all know, pretty tough business unto itself. We also need the food products that we buy at the airport, grocery store. I mean, I'll tell you, we've been really trying to crack a nut with hotels. I mean, there's so many hotels that talk about their footprint and emissions and how sustainable they are. And, you know, they don't even want to try a sample of food that is grown vastly better and actually makes a difference. Their whole food program across the country, when you look at scale, mm-hmm. could actually be totally transformed. Airlines, I mean, we all know what we get when we pick out of that basket.
Oh God, yeah.
But that's a huge area of impact, right?
Yeah.
And they are vastly subsidized and supported by our government, and none of that is really moving in the right direction. So I do feel the way to get there is also to be focusing on products, outlets, and fueling that demand with a, you know, a community that wants it and a community that's trying to grow it.
Mm.
To me, it seems far from impossible.
Yeah.
The roots are there. Someone's got to agree to water it.
Yeah, we just need to, and the dots need to be connected. And I think, you know, it kind of actually makes me think, Camilla, because you said that you guys are processing your sort of food in a really interesting way. And that's something that's been coming up a lot. It's like, okay, so we get the farmers and they're growing regeneratively, and we've got the consumers and they want a really pure product. Where does that get processed? Like, where do you put the, you know, it's one thing to like grow a tomato and put that on the stand, but, you know, to grow avocados that then get made into avocado oil in a glass jar and end up on a shelf. Like, how are you guys trying to go along a supply chain that also meets your ethos, because I feel like that's another huge issue.
So look, we've been around for a year. We're in final process for getting B Corp certification. We're Planet Forward certified. Julia, there's my dog.
Hi.
She does not like, see, I told you, the kids always break into the room. That was perfectly on time. Julia Collins from Planet Forward, who created Moonshot Snacks, has been a longtime friend and mentor. We were assessed by them in our first year. And then we also connected them. So we're joint certified by Planet Forward and Climate Neutral. Mm. Very unusual for a company in their first 12 months to be able to do all of that. All of that data shows us that we are by far leading in a carbon neutral supply chain by a lot. And the biggest two, it was interesting because a lot of the rhetoric, this was my hypothesis, but I wanted the data and the third party assessment to validate it. All we hear about is transit, right? I do think, again, the average person, I think a lot of the rhetoric has been around emissions related to transit. Oh, you're flying a product from XYZ location, you're getting it from your manufacturing to your logistics to the consumer's door. That seems like a lot. Mm. Regenerative farming literally blows that out of the water.
Right.
The carbon capture from how you source blows any transit emissions out of the water. Second is packaging. Mm. Transit is third and trails by a lot.
So really?
The thing that we're focusing on and tracking actually is not the key to carbon neutral food production.
And why is this seems like a stupid question, but I'm going to ask it anyway. Why is packaging, because there might be a few people going, why is packaging so bad? Is it just because
the petroleum? It's not about so bad. It's just when you look at the actual emissions, it just is on a multitude level, way bigger of a culprit than transit.
And is that because mostly it's from plastic, which is inherently made from petroleum bases, or?
I mean, it's not just plastic. Plastic's a big reason, but it's all of it, right? It's none of it's made from natural sources. You know, it's forever in our environment. Again, this is not even to mention health, you know.
Oh,
the bigger thing is I think that living in harmony with all of this, living in harmony with Mother Nature is also better for our health.
Yeah.
So for me, a lot of it is marrying the two, because we also need to be thinking about sustainability for our health. What happens as we go on? That's not sustainable either.
No, it's funny. Actually, on our flight here from Boston, I was next to, it was the most fascinating 5 hours, because I spoke to this guy the whole time. He was an environmental cleanup. He goes around the world cleaning up environmental toxins, oil spills, all this stuff. And we were on the subject of PFAS, and he was like, you do know that PFAS is in like every fast food wrapper. Like they put it, if you're getting like a breakfast sandwich. Yeah. And it stops like the grease. It's easy to like put everything in.
Right,
and, like,
I can tell you everything with restaurants. So when we did our zero waste certification, it was fascinating because they said we were the only company. A lot of the questions said, well, what did you shift from X to Y?
Yeah.
Right. Like, okay, you used to have that wrapper. Now tell us about the new one. And we would write, well, we never had that one.
Right.
We just have the compostable one.
Right.
Right. Like we never had that. We started with no plastic from the start. So it's interesting. And again, a lot comes down to cost, unfortunately. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's such a deep pressure. You know, we get it even ourselves. Like our tamper bans are home compostable. Mm-hmm. They're not plastic. That is an added cost. It's a whole layer of application, mm-hmm. you know, and yet a lot of companies are raising a lot of money with plastic packaging saying that they're better for you. They're leaching in. I mean, I don't know if you read that New York Times. That really made me. I mean, again, I'm a mom of three and like, obviously I've spent my whole career in food and health and the planet, but we're eating about a credit card worth of plastic every single week. I mean, like, do we need to, again, this is where I sort of sit and go, like, do we need more data for something to change? Like, I'm confused why we're still making plastic cheap. When we are paying for plastic to be cheap. So, you know, I'm beside myself when I do things like that, and just it's out there and there's no reason that it is subsidized the way that it is.
Yeah.
And killing us in the meantime.
Yeah, no, it's great. And
people still buy it.
Zach brought it up in his podcast as well. You know,
a lot of products out there packaged in plastic that are crazy funded on every shelf. Every person I know who's health conscious has it on their, you know, in their kitchen, in their pantries. And you're like, I don't understand how you look at me in one realm and say you care about the planet, you care about your health, and yet plastic is everywhere. I just,
well, I also think it almost just feels unavoidable. Like even when you're super, you know what I mean? It does, like, it feels like, oh my God, if I go to the grocery store, like I can't get meat, for instance, if it's not, you know what I mean? Like there's no alternative. It just almost feels like there has to be companies like yours leading in the space, showing that it can be done and pushing this forward. And
well, so our next year, one of our big pushes in grocery is going to be our snacks, which from day one, we're in home compostable pouches.
Yeah.
And it's been so fascinating and eye-opening to talk to these grocery buyers, you know, to talk to these big chains. It's never really been done before, not in a high velocity category. Mm. You know, again, you talk to hotels, you talk to airlines, look at airport, you know, food service. That has to change. I mean, yeah, that is my vision for the future, is that you go to an airport and not every option is super unhealthy, super processed, and in a plastic bag.
Yeah.
I think we can do better. And frankly, we just have to do better.
We have to do better, 100%. And I think kind of one of my last questions is getting more back into the regenerative farming. How do you find your farms? You know, like
I ask this all the time.
Yeah, because I like, it's got to be one of the first questions, right?
I'll tell you my theory on a larger scale, but then I'll also sort of break it down more practically. On a bigger scale, I've always believed this. Again, I'm a capitalist, but I really do believe this to my core. We are human. The world is run by people. Businesses are run by people. Communities are run by people. Mm-hmm. Anything you do, I mean, it's amazing when I talk. I'm also an active angel investor. I've been on the road, you know, for fundraising with our own company. It's amazing how much I think people, particularly when you look at things through a business lens, lose sight of that. Mm. And they do think the world is so transactional and they think that money buys anything and it doesn't. How so? Bigger sense is everything comes down to people. I have always been able, I don't know, I've always seen doors open because of that philosophy. And it's funny because it's exactly how I mean regenerative farms. Yeah. I mean, I had a big farm community in New York because I spent my career in restaurants,
right,
and just, but I'm the person who would say, I'm going to come and work for the day on your farm. And they're like, who is this crazy redhead who just showed up? And I'm like, I don't even know how to get there. I'll figure it out.
Yeah.
My husband would be like, where are you going for the day? I'm like, I'm gonna go work the earth. Like, I want to learn what they're doing. I mean, truly, that's literally how I met Dan's team. Was I was like, can I people work for free? And you're like, who are, like, don't you have a high level job? I'm like, nope, still want to learn.
Yeah.
So, you know, I think it's being willing to build those relationships, really putting yourself out there. I had a big community in New York. And honestly, one of my fears coming back, people say, oh, you're from here, you're back home. I said, I haven't lived here in 20 years.
Yeah.
Like, I could well be on Mars, to be honest. It's not the same. So when I came here, I was very concerned and a little bit afraid. Like, it was kind of starting from scratch. I didn't know where to begin. And I'll never forget, we had a limited edition holiday product run. We had an argument with our co-manufacturer. It was so ridiculous. And I said to him, look, I only work with good people. That's my philosophy. And so we needed to switch where we were making the product. And he was holding our ingredients hostage. So I literally cold called a regenerative farm out on the West Coast. And I said, like, do you have green plums? They were like, actually, we were just about to figure out what to do with our seconds and thirds. Yeah, but you got to pick them up tomorrow. And I was like, great. Never underestimate the power of a phone call. Yeah. Never underestimate a cold call. But I was touched. The farmer wrote back and he said, I know who you are. And I said, really? He's like, I do. I said, all right. So honestly, we find a lot of regenerative farms because I've been doing this and in this community for a long time. I hope I've done right by them. I hope that I'm able to be an advocate in a genuine way. Yeah. And they all know each other. They are all 6 degrees of separation, just like any industry.
Yeah.
It is such a tight community. And so a lot of the ways I find others is like, hey, do you know this one? Do you know that one? I mean, that's how I met Matt Agriculture. I found them on the internet and we emailed them just off the cuff. And, you know, one thing leads to another. So, you know, again, that's how I find them. That's how I piece it together. But I also think it's just about thinking that everything's really about people.
I love that. And thank you for saying that.
Don't be afraid to visit. It's so fun.
Yeah. And it's such a refresh. You know, we talk about this a lot, like technology's coming up in so many of these conversations, like the good and the evil and the AI and the non-AI and stuff. And I think, like, ultimately at the end of the day, there is just this human element that like we keep coming back to. And, you know, with farmers in particular, it seems like there's so many emotional connections that people make that are beautiful. And I guess,
well, and to that point, you know, again, I get asked by investors, well, what stops someone from copying you? And I said, well, one, they're not me. So yeah, good luck to them. But two, we want a lot of regenerative products. I'm not trying to corner the market. That defies the entire mission as well. Can't patent Mother Nature, can't patent natural food. Patent processed food, that's part of our problem. Don't get me started. That's a whole other episode. Newsflash. Again, I'm a JD MBA. I'm also like have a very weird background. But the fact that you can't legally protect recipes or anything that relates to food is honestly so crazy to me. Why we can patent algorithms but not recipes, and then to the outside world, none of that has value, which also is problematic unto itself.
Mm-hmm.
Food should not be patented. That's part of our problem in our processed world. But I do think that the way that you think about regenerative farms and how it gets to the rest is just that. It is about building those relationships. And I would say to investors, look, I don't want us to be the only ones, but the way that we do it is different. I think the way that we do it is much longer term. Mm-hmm. And I think we're doing it uniquely, but I hope that there are others, because all of these farms need a lot more support to make this mainstream and to hit the tipping point.
Well, exactly. And I think we can end with the question that you brought up, the story you kind of told me that.
Can imagine how you feel about school food.
Imagine
me at nursery school. I'm like, why are we using Dixie cups?
My mom was like that. She came in and I was the only kid in my entire class that had like a home cooked meal, and she's bringing it in. She got told off by the principal and she went on a crusade. She was like, this is insane.
Untradeable lunch.
Yeah, exactly.
Gives you a lot of strength.
Exactly. So I feel like in terms of, because you're working with regenerative farms and there's biodiversity, like tell me about the ingredients and like how you're kind of using up all the ingredients. Cause that's like a big thing, right? With monocultures, it's like, oh, I need this one ingredient, so I go to this one farm because they're growing all of that. But with regenerative farms, with all of these different things they're growing and the ingredients, like how do you
put them together?
Yeah. So tell us about the ingredients.
I look at that as, again, I think it's a little bit of the fable, and the way people want to write it off is by saying that, oh, it's small. Oh, it's intermittent. Oh, it's not countable. There are ways to put them together in creative ways. I think that there's a lot more collaboration amongst farms than people realize, just like restaurants, we all help each other. And I do think, again, it is going to have to change the food supply system, right? Mm-hmm. The tail has to wag the dog. You can't say you believe in biodiversity and then have this requirement for everything being uniform from one source, you know, exactly as you want it every single day. I do think that products have to be more creatively, you know, formulated and generated, which is, you know, why chefs should run food companies.
And that's and I would assume it's like actually more fun to run companies that way, right? Like, it's like, you're not making the same exact thing every time. It allows for some like creativity and diversity.
Or find another product for, you know, a different crop. I mean, yes, I do think it's about being nimble. I think it's about being creative. And I think it's about putting together the farms, crops, and seasonality in sort of a consortium rather than being like, you're my regenerative farm. You're the only one that's going to grow. That's not really realistic. And that cuts against the very purpose of the system.
Yeah. Well, I feel like this has all been so wonderful, Camilla. And I just want to finish with the question I ask everybody at the end of the podcast, because we always cover all of these kind of like dark and big topics. But what is the thing?
That wasn't dark.
No, yours was actually shockingly light for like regenerative and not.
You told me you cried before coming here. I was like, I don't know if I'm going to come here.
Well, we were talking oceans, which I mean, that's a whole other literal kettle of fish. But not light.
And watching our kids be poisoned by processed food is pretty dark.
Yeah, it is. And I feel like, that being said, that when you were talking about the next generation coming up, I mean, my God, like they're shocking in terms of their commitment. You know, like I was saying, I lived in Paris for 6 years. It was in my early 20s. I mean, I didn't care about anything. Like I was just having a good time. I was drinking. I was eating, you know, and I see these kids now and it's like, oh my God, they're registering to vote. They're organizing, you know, they're amazing. So, I mean, it might not be what your answer is, but what is the thing that's making you feel the most hopeful at the moment?
Oh, I will say I am always an extreme optimist. So truly everything. I think every hurdle, speed bump, boulder that gets in our way is just an opportunity to figure out a new route. I don't know. I always say I'm the eternal optimist, you know, for better or otherwise.
That's perfect. Amazing. Thank you, Camilla. Thank you so
Thanks
much.
Thanks for having me.
And yeah, I can't wait to see the next phase of Westbourne.
Me too. And again, thank you for doing what you're doing and bringing together these incredible, impactful voices. You know, as I said, people listening to podcasts like yours is what changes their minds, changes their behavior. And it does have to be both sides of the coin, right? Growers can't do it alone. And we have to shift the system as people who individually and then collectively, you know, can drive those change, those different decisions and push the system into a different direction. We can.